Ladies and gentlemen, it's my great honor. You're a doctor, right?
Yes.
So it's my great honor to introduce Dr. George Greer, who was doing research on psychotherapeutic use of MDMA back when it was still legal everywhere. So this is it's an enormous honor for me. You're welcome. He's camping with us. Sylvia Lisson and John Hanna, whom you've just heard talking, and of course, the ones and the onlys. Earth and Fire Aeroid on the panel. I will do my best to moderate. I don't even know where to begin, but perhaps...
Switch with you.
No, I'll be fine. I'll be fine. George, do you want to talk to people a little bit about your work, since perhaps they're a little bit less familiar with it than they would be with the work of these other people?
Sure, and actually I brought something to talk about that fits in with what you guys and we all have been talking about. It's fresh, refreshing to see people trying to jump on that trampoline and stay in the air. But basically, Rieke Wick-Calvert, my wife and I, gave MDMA to people for 5 years when it was legal until 1985 as a psychiatrist. And about 80 people, and I made it in Sasha Silgan's lab, so it was a completely bureaucratically legal supply of MDMA. And Leo Zeff showed us how to do it, and he had done a lot of things, given LSD for 20 or so years before that. So that's what we did, and we experimented with some other later called designer drugs, psychedelic drugs that were not named until 1986, when they also became illegal. So we did led a whole lobbying thing in Congress to try to save that, but there's a big wave going the other way at that time. So that's sort of what we did. I'm a psychiatrist. And when people would say, well, how do the drugs work, or what do you do, how does this work, how does this help people, I just wrote up a couple of pages of some thoughts based on Arthur Young's reflexive universe model of the universe, inner and outer universe. And I hate to try to refer to reading, but I haven't thought about this in a long time, so I'm just gonna go through it. And it's a, you know, it's an idea, it's a meme that you know, might be helpful. So the whole idea is using altered states to experience choice. And then the question is, you know, the people's question is, well, why take MDMA? Why take psilocybin? What's the point? What do you get out of it? You know, what's it for? And the main question needs to be answered. This is the main question that needs to be answered, because I think it's the most important question that determines what the experience is. I mean, a lot of it's out of our control, but deciding what the purpose is, why are you doing this, I think is the thing we have some control over. So let me divide up the world in four levels. First is physical, the level that where sensory perceptions, things seem hard and three-dimensional, time goes in a linear fashion. It follows the laws of high school physics, you know, pre-Einstein. There's no real freedom here, it's just all billiard balls bouncing around. The next level is mental, the level of thoughts and ideas. They're not physical, they're concepts. We can communicate them verbally to each other, and they're defined in relationship to each other. These are the objective world that we share, the physical world, the cultural world of words. The next level is a little harder to find. It's inner feelings, moods, emotions, values when it's combined with thoughts, some psychic phenomena, inner experiences, and it's just things that flow, that are hard to define, that it's substance without form, as opposed to form without substance. Then and as you get up to these levels, we have a little more control, a little more freedom to do things. You know, we can play with words. Emotions are unpredictable. It's hard to predict an emotion. And then the fourth level is you could call it spiritual or existential. This is the level where we make choices and decisions. This is where purpose originates and where it's realized, where we decide, okay, I achieved my purpose. There are no limits or definition possible at this ineffable level of mystical experience. It's completely open, and it just is. It can't be taken away or destroyed. It's unaffected by the other levels. In a way, it's beyond experience, the way Robert was saying a bit ago. So this is just an intellectual framework laying out some levels here. And the basic concept, and this is Arthur Young's idea, is that with each level, there's more and more degrees of freedom. And he has a whole geometry about 1 degree, 2 degree, 3 degrees of freedom. So the point, one point of taking a psychedelic drug is to get to this highest level of experiencing ourselves and do something there. When we, in everyday life, our experience moves among these levels very rapidly, maybe several times a second. We focus on a sense impression, put a name on it, feel how much we like it, and maybe impulsively move toward it or away from it. And sometimes we consciously decide to pay attention to it. So this is going on very rapidly. Habits of moving our bodies, thinking and feeling develop as a way of coping with our environment. And I like this definition of karma is our bad habits, because that's kind of what we're born into. If we don't consciously decide, then we just go along with our habits. And only intermittently does our awareness enter this level where we are aware that, oh, we've really got a lot of choices here. This is different. And when we're self-aware in making a conscious choice, when we know I'm really choosing this right now, like the woman who did the poetry earlier, I mean, she obviously spent a lot of time there consciously deciding who she's going to be and what she's going to do with her life and how she's going to express it. She's been there and come back to tell us her in words and feeling her experience of that. Making these choices doesn't always mean we do something with our material bodies. It might just be a matter of, in meditation, you mentioned meditation, of just what we choose to attend to in the moment. And our body may not move at all. So at these times when we're consciously making a choice and we're fully involved in it, this to me is being fully alive. There's no conflict, no problem to solve, no doubt. It's just the action of choosing.
Wait, if there's no conflict or doubt, where's the choice?
Let me finish.
Okay, yeah. Sorry.
The idea is that the more this happens, the better in a sense, and this is my value system, the better in a sense we'll go, the better we'll be, the more conscious we will have created ourselves. So, psychedelics. When our brain is under the influence of a psychedelic drug, our habits are disabled to various degrees. Our circuits, our habits, they don't work in the same way. It's like putting a computer program in a computer that's been rewired or operating in a different frequency. The usual pattern of flow running in our heads goes into dead ends. The computer keeps asking the operator what to do, so the operator has to make a choice. So we're forced into making choices about what to do, how we see things. Do we think these entities are real? Do we think this scenario of what's really going on in the world is real? We're called upon to make that choice in that state, and it's not an easy choice to make. Our brains are similar in this way. The drug changes the brain chemistry, changes the way the nerve cells communicate. Habitual patterns don't work well. And again, we're confronted with what is our purpose? To the extent that our purpose is easily realized, this can be a very wonderful experience and very whole. But if we don't know what our purpose is, or we know but we can't fulfill it, then it can be a difficult experience. This difficulty pushes us to change our purpose or change ourselves so we can move closer to some chosen goal. I think a great deal of learning can take place in that situation where we don't know what's going on and we've got to do something or decide something to stand to live with ourselves. So depending on how altered we are, the things we learn and the new patterns we consciously arrange in our minds at those times can still be operational once the drug's out of our system. The more patterns are broken up, the more choices we have a chance to make. However, the more they are fragmented, the less we can bring them back with us, because the less they relate to the world we live in every day. Fortunately, with psychedelic drugs, to varying degrees, the altered state returns to normal gradually, so a gradual transition and repatterning can take place. One may not be able to re-experience exactly what happened during the altered state, but it can be labeled in a way that the everyday mind understands, so that one can be certain that it did actually happen. You may not exactly remember this ineffable mystic experience, but you know you had it. There's no doubt about it, that it happened. And then when the session is over, when you're back in everyday life, you can decide to learn more simple, efficient, and practical ways of being able to make more choices in everyday life, rather than having to take a big dose of acid or something.
Every day.
Without having to spend a lot of time in that altered state. And I think that's really the goal of meditation, is to be able to be in that place in the moment. So that's an idea I would throw out to people as a way to work with themselves in the altered state and bring something back into their lives that they felt was useful to them.
I think we have probably have a couple of your papers printed out over here.
Right. From our MDMA work, right?
Yeah. Take a look.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
I don't really understand when you said the moment that we're fully alive, and this is when you're not altered. The moment that you're fully alive is when you're making a choice, and then you said, and there's no conflict or doubt. And I didn't understand what you meant by that.
What I meant was that at times when we are of those levels, when we're operating from the level of most freedom,
okay,
where we're aware of all our options, all our abilities, all our skills, all our intelligence, and we feel like, okay, I'm caught up. I know I've got all the information I need emotionally, spiritually, and I'm choosing to do this right now. It might be a creative act. It might be saying something to someone you care about. At those times, I would say that's a way of saying I'm my whole self right now.
Because like all of you is behind what you're doing?
Yes, yeah, because all of me is behind what I'm doing right now, and I feel whole, and there's no interior conflict about it. I'm not ambivalent about doing this right now, whatever that is. So that's what I mean by, does that answer?
Yeah, thank you very much.
The question?
Yeah, this question is for you, and maybe if anyone else on the panel is interested. Would you say that the revelation type of experience from MDMA and where one makes choices and then the same kind of, is that like similar or related to the revelatory experience that you could get from mushrooms or LSD, for example? Are these two different separate means of achieving revelation? Are some of them more likely than others to produce like a revelatory experience, or less? Like you were going to say.
I wish our government would invest in that research question, because it's a really important question.
What was really interesting, I should mention, when the Griffith Report came out, it got enormous coverage. It was everywhere.
It passed the mom
test.
Is that
the one that says
when your mom does?
Yes. Says mystical experience.
Yes. Shocking though that may be. Yes.
I got hundreds of emails from different people sending me the same thing.
But I mean, it was just like all of the mainstream news outlets in Australia carried it. Not television, but print outlets.
Yeah.
England and America. It was in USA Today.
Yeah.
It was the front page of the Santa Fe Daily newspaper.
How many people know what the study said, whatever? John sort of mentioned it a little bit, but the primary thing was just that they showed in a way that was, testable, that...
Well-done research.
Yeah. Fairly well-done research, that if you give someone psilocybin, that they report that that these people who had never
in
had
very specific
any,
circumstances. Very so they were, you know, in a friendly environment, eyes closed, music, blindfold, lying down with supportive.
They'd gone through months of preparation, effectively several sessions where they had been provided a bunch of literature and counseling, and their families had been contacted in order to be part of the study. They had to agree to have, I think, two different external contacts who would be able to sort of report on how the person's mental health was and
after the
whatever,
experience.
Both before, during, and after the trial. And what they found was that the people, a large portion of the people given psilocybin reported a mystical experience and an experience that was one of the two most important experiences of their lives or whatever. And
yeah. Say with the birth of a child.
Right. Yeah, another important thing about that is the people who gave them the psilocybin or with them were Bill Richards and I think his son Brian Richards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's important because Bill Richards worked with giving LSD to people in the 70s, dying to terminally ill people. He was part of the Maryland Research Institute with Stan Groff and those people. So he had a lot of experience. Plus, he's a really warm, kind, smart person. And he's religiously educated. He's published in articles on religion and in questions that we're talking about in religion. So he's an educated, warm, empathic person who understands a lot, and he's not like probably a typical American psychiatrist in the early 50s in a white lab coat giving someone LSD with a notepad saying, okay, so what's happening now? I think that's a critical factor.
I think the kicker, the thing that's going to make that stick is that in the 6-month interview, at least 50% of these people reported that they were fundamentally happier in their lives.
And that was supported by interviews of their friends and family.
Yeah, exactly. Their family members said, yeah, he's better.
Yeah. Uh-huh. That's the thing that's going to stick. It's not, okay, you took drugs and had a mystical experience.
I loved it. Let's have more.
Right. It's that 6 months later, these people were happier.
Right.
All right.
And their families said they were.
Yeah. They were objectively happier.
One of the things that's really interesting.
Go ahead, this thought has been going on for a few minutes. Earlier today, Matt Baggett, who's a researcher in San Francisco, talked about his work with the study of psychedelics and consciousness. And he said something that I thought was really cogent and related to what we're talking about here. And he used the psilocybin study as an example, which is the idea of making psychedelics boring. Like, we want to make psychedelics boring. And that's why, you know, Arrowhead is making such an effort to get people to describe with words about the experiences and why the psilocybin study was so important is you're applying a scientific method to something that, you know, lots of people in the world can relate to scientific method, less people can relate to the psychedelic experience. So if you describe a psychedelic experience with a scientific method, then it renders it boring and mundane for a lot of people. And mundanity is familiar and comfortable, and that's good.
Yeah, that's very much what I was going to say. Is just that what's really interesting about the study for me is that it really points out strongly to me something that I know, but that I sometimes forget, is that there's these communities of people interested in very similar topics that don't talk to each other.
Right.
And that you get research published about this topic, about, you know, the impact of psilocybin and the spiritual experience, and a whole lot of people who have taken mushrooms are like, oh, well, of course.
Yeah.
Like, what? When this is stupid research. Why did you waste money doing this research? This is the most obvious thing that I've ever heard, right? And yet, the world out there, some, you know, this other piece thinks it's like this, oh my God, look at this news, and you know, just that there's this clash of...
It helps terrify people. They're making it boring as good.
Yeah, right.
Boring drugs.
Boring drugs.
Things that are outside of your normal personality's control scare people.
Yes.
And it's very hard.
Say that again. I'm sorry.
Things that put you out of control of your experience, put your personality out of control of its experience, are scary. In University of Arizona, they did a study with psilocybin, giving it to people with obsessive compulsive disorder, who had failed at regular medical treatment. So you can imagine people with obsessive compulsive disorder like to have things in order. They had a very hard time finding anybody to take psilocybin for that study, even though there were reports that, hey, I took psilocybin and for weeks I wasn't obsessive compulsive. It's terrifying. I mean, why would you want to do that?
So if you try to map out what people are experiencing and create this map that other people can relate to and can kind of see how it relates to their own experience, like maybe in some way baseball relates to psychedelics and we don't know about it, but if we start creating maps, it'll...
So there's overlaps.
It's overlapping.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like very few people like to get their teeth cleaned. But everyone does it every 6 months because you got to.
Right. Because there's a bad consequence.
Right, and it's a loss of control. I mean, apparently about the scariest thing for people is to have someone stick their hands down their mouths. You know, I know it's an extreme claustrophobia. Yeah.
Really?
It's pretty intimate.
Yeah, exactly. It's extremely intimate.
I had an experience in Huautla where I talked to the kids there that are part of that community, mushroom-taking community. And we asked them, because children are usually pretty honest and direct, you know, if it's a part of their culture still, or if it's been suppressed by the Catholic Church and everything. And I said, oh, no, the priests, they like it that we do it because, you know, we see the Virgin and everything. And, and they go, and so are you planning on taking it? Well, when we're 13 or 14, we'll probably, you know, we'll take some with our shaman. But it's a medicine.
Right. You know?
And it's like a totally a part of their culture. I go, well, what do you guys plan on doing? Are you... Well, we want to be engineers, and you know, they're just regular folk, but they have this as already a part of their conditioning.
Mm-hmm. This was where?
In Huautla,
Mexico.
You know, an original question was, you predict what medicine will yield what kind of experience. You know, are you going to get more of this from psilocybin or MDMA? And which is our, you know, that's a scientific question. That's our curiosity about mapping. And the answer is, there's no way that you can predict that kind of thing.
I mean, probably.
People are so different. It's like this morning we were saying, you know, MDMA is not normally thought of as a major hallucinogen. People really don't have distortion of their sensory apparatus. And yet, because some people are really ripe for that, every now and then you'll give something, you know, you'll give a little baby dose of MDMA or a crumb of a mushroom, and people will completely have a once-in-a-lifetime experience. So, you know, there's yeah, probably mushrooms more, yeah, LSD, but there's so much in terms of genetics.
Yeah, it's so much individual variation between people and between experience.
This is true for all medicine.
You know what? You have to ask
the
regulatory process
is all about looking at what is the average effect across the whole population.
Yeah, people want,
and then you still decide
and what the contraindications are.
Right. Yeah.
People want certainty, and so I mean, we want. I mean, I think that one of the things that we're talking about is just maybe making people a little bit more comfortable or encouraging people to talk a little bit more in terms of sometimes, probably, in some cases, and this is one of the things Arrowhead does. And if more, I mean, I think that if more people talked like that, it would open other people up who are so addicted to certainty to choice.
Yeah, certainty. I mean, so addicted to what they perceive as certainty.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, well, Leo Zeff, who was our psychedelic teacher, said, you know, if I'm really certain about something, there's only one thing I know about that, is that I'm wrong. And then Don...
Was he certain about that?
You know, he
convinced us.
He talked with a certain tone when he said that. And then Carlos Castaneda says that Don Juan said that clarity is the enemy of the mind. You know, when your mind is clear and everything's ordered and organized, you know, you're lost.
Confusion means, you know, with fusion.
Yeah.
Bring together.
Yeah. On fusion.
Hmm. Yeah, and then there's the Sufi story of there's God and the devil walking together, and God says, look, you know, what's this? Oh, this is like, you know, the universe I created. And the devil says, oh, let me organize it for you.
Well, I know that I'm a psychologist, and I often refer parents to Arrowhead And just the other day, I had a client who's, I think their daughter smoked pot for the first time and was trying to get drunk, or did get drunk, you know, and then she was ill a few days later, and her mother says, and I told her that she was sick from drugs and alcohol. And I, you know, she saw the look on my face and she said, shouldn't I have told her that? And I said, no. No, because it's not true, you know. If you're gonna try to really work with your kid, you need to know what's true. And so I referred her, you know, to Erwood. I said, you know, what you find here will be factual. There's neither pro nor con.
People actually have the notion that you can go to Erwood and find certainty there and find facts there.
Well, more facts than what they get from.
And they have to. They have to be encouraged to apply critical thinking.
Better than nothing. That's our new slogan.
Better than nothing. Someone get this on a T-shirt.
Should make an Erwood T-shirt. There's a lot of information, and anything you find written up, you know, is like, oh, there's a lot of people who know about this.
I live in
St. Louis, and in the prejudice against any, I mean, people have never heard of doing psychedelics the way we talk about doing psychedelics, and they really get freaked out. So I have to do something, you know. I often refer them to some of the books on medical marijuana. There are a couple of good books that are almost pure textbooks on that.
I'm interested in, I don't know if you can pick an anecdote or something, but how do you, if someone is going through a lot of changes or thought processes in their lives, and they have a therapeutic session with MDMA or LSD, they see something. You know it's going to fade. They're going to remember that they saw something that showed them a difference. But how can that be applied through action in ordinary life?
How to hold on to it?
Not necessarily hold on to the thing or the truth you saw, but...
Okay.
But the direction
is it?
How to make the most of it, how to carry it into... Because we all have, you know... life responsibilities that our karma has saddled us with.
I think talking about it with the person they're closest to bring it into that relationship, can make it more into their life, and then the person they're closest to can talk back to them about it in their normal state, and that can help reinforce it. That's the first thing that comes to my mind. You know, not proselytize to a stranger, but someone like you really are connected with.
Well, I joke that half of the time I spend on drugs, I spend talking about drugs. And that's talking about the experience, and that helps you remember it, right? It helps you remember things about it that you can take away and use.
Yeah. Our brains are different when we're talking than when we're not talking. And the verbal level, I mean, there's parts of our brain that are more verbal and that are nonverbal, more emotional. I mean, there are areas of the brain, and the more all of them are involved, the brain, I believe, is more integrated. And there are a lot of therapies based on that, you know, integrating the verbal and the emotional parts of the brain so that we are more whole and present all the time.
Mark, are you moderating, or?
I am. Well, I mean,
in the back.
This is sort of self-moderating. Right. We have about 5 more minutes to sort of...
Okay.
So with in that integration that you were just saying, you know, with drawing and maybe physical expression through body movement, like multiple platforms for expression.
Everything, yes.
Yeah. Jacob?
You know, I do think about this question of integration a lot because you come back from the amazing session and you make your sort of New Year's resolution. And you go, did that really change anything? But I really appreciate that new research where they're doing these pre-work, ketamine-assisted, therapy, and then follow-up sessions that keep bringing them back to the experience they had. I think, you know, that's kind of, anyway, for me, the only way I can really, you know, is to just keep going back to those experiences on a regular basis and think about what that resolution was and then see if I'm actually continuing it. The process that would get me to where I need to go in order to complete that.
I'd like to just speak. I'm a psychotherapist, and I deal a lot with helping people to change, and I found that change, real change in terms of life change, is one of the trickiest and most difficult things there is. And there's a huge difference between a powerful internal experience, which is available in a variety of ways, and then how that experience becomes some kind of practical learning that becomes utilized in a person's life in a way that means something to that person. And I think there's this huge gap, and we tend to get fixated on the internal experience, which is very interesting. And then we talk about the internal experience, but that can also dissipate. I think that integration process is really quite alchemical and very delicate and very complicated. I don't think we know very much about it yet.
Well, from your own experience as a psychotherapist, what have you found? Is it, does it vary completely from individual or to individual, or are there certain things
techniques
that have come up to you as sort of as elements in that alchemical transformation?
Yeah, I think, you know, there has to be a continuing focus on some kind of learning message of the experience. And there has to be a sort of behavioral engagement. And talking is not enough.
They have to do.
There has to be some kind of doing that becomes integrated enough that it stays in that person's life pattern. And that takes a lot of perseverance. And it takes
really
a lot of support. And it takes a lot of luck.
There's some really good ways to do that, though. Like if you combine things like meditation, medicine, and magic all together, you can create a more integrated experience. Have a higher yoga through these things.
Yeah.
Use your kundalini to direct the flow of your psychic patterning, and it can come on in a more subtle way. The integration can be more gentle, more complete, more into all of the levels of your being, less whoosh, and then hopefully we grabbed it when we were there.
Yeah, it's almost as if we need to distrust our epiphanies a little bit.
Yeah, we had to follow through with the message of it. You have to do your homework. If you just trip all the time and you don't, you know, it's like if you have big dreams, you wake up in the night, you have a big dream, that was fabulous. But if you don't do your homework about what it's telling you to do, you might not get another one for a while.
Well,
you know, if you don't do your homework, you got to finish and really anchor it, yeah.
Well, so in Basel, Jeremy Narby brought up something that really struck me that relates to what you just said, Rekha, but where he was giving a talk, and he said that the shamans that he actually read this in a book, and I had to find the reference, which I haven't read myself yet, so this is hearsay at this point, but there are shamans in, I'm going to say Peru, I'm not sure where, who talk about Yahe being a liar, which really struck me as interesting, because there's this an assumption, I think, among a lot of us that the visions that people experience are the truth. It's like, oh, you know, there's this truth of this epiphany that I had, and I have to, like, act on it. And it's not necessarily the truth. It could be a lie. The, you know, the insects could have been lying to you. So,
it's not what you don't know that'll hurt you. It's what you know that ain't so.
Yeah.
Or that you may be encountering the spirit of the hill over there, who likes to pretend he's some insectoid creature.
Yeah.
I mean, if you don't believe in the insectoid creature, there's no reason
not to.
He's
just playing with you, and
someone I know had sort of charted out the different plants, his feeling of, you know, well, mescaline will tell you the truth 90% of the time. Ketamine, you can't trust at all.
Right.
Zero. You know, just different percentages.
What was the highest one on that scale?
I think it was mescaline. Mescaline was
the most trustworthy.
Ketamine was the least trustworthy.
Yep. Not ayahuasca,
huh? I don't remember what that there was an ayahuasca. Somebody said ayahuasca is a liar.
Having a
stroke
credibility.
Right. Harder numbers.
Survey.
Well,
another map.
A couple of things that I wanted to address, like as you were talking as a psychotherapist, I think in working with ecstasy myself, and someone just mentioned it at the other lecture about how the heart math people have measured the field of the heart and everything. And so working with ecstasy has allowed me to go deeper into my own heart and to open it more. And so when I'm working with clients, often I can open that and I can, you know, tell that that's where I'm at. I'm at that very heart opening. And the heart math people have found that that projects for 15 feet and begins to start up an entrainment. And so I'm actually entraining my clients in moving them, moving their energy levels up to a different place. And then the second thing in terms of action, that I guess it's invisible action, is when I've had an experience in a psychedelic way, or even now, not even, it doesn't have to be necessarily psychedelic, rather than pay attention to what's out here, I pay attention to the inner constellation. How does it feel inside my body? How does it feel inside my physiology? What's my mind doing? And I try to take an internal print of that so that I can access that state independent of outside reference. And I found that that's been very helpful and worthwhile to do.
Will you write up an experience report about that, please?
Sure.
We need data. We're getting down to the last few minutes.
Okay, last question.
Thanks. I just want to ask a follow-up question to what I asked earlier. So we pretty much mushrooms established mushrooms are definitely going to give you...
mushrooms are what?
Good. Mushrooms will give you a revelatory experience. Or at least they're...
Still
alive.
Can.
Psilocybin.
No certainty here.
Right. Psilocybin.
Right.
But, I mean, what would be... what I'm kind of curious about is what other types of drugs are involved for this sort of revelatory
effect. My answer is everything.
Yeah.
I mean, I went on a Vipassana retreat for my first one for like 11 days, and I had absolutely every kind of experience mm-hmm. I ever had on any psychedelic drug, except for visual hallucinations.
I had visual hallucinations at the
Say that louder.
And I was just sitting and breathing and attending to my experience.
Yeah.
So, fly
it's
dust.
Possible with
fly
dust.
Fly dust.
There are many roads.
If anyone wants to buy some of just that fly dust, fly dust in 1 gram allotment.
Okay.
I had visual hallucinations on the 15th ship.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah.
The whole room turned gold. Uh-huh. It was all the stuff emanating when I told my teacher being
Yeah.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's thank our panel for really, really.